You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast. It's me, Matt Morgan, with my good buddy, my partner, my co-host. It's Dana Roach, who also, he's kind of like Waldo, where he only wears stripes, but it's because he doesn't want to be spotted. So Dana, how are you doing today?
Did you hear about the restaurant on the moon?
I didn't.
Great food, but no atmosphere.
I'm pretty sure every third dad joke you do these days has been recycled from me at one point in time.
It's the moon. We have to recycle everything.
I mean, it goes in and out. It's like the tides.
right, exactly.
In and out of style, that is. But welcome, everybody. We're here this week, and we have a great topic for you. Joey's taking a little week off, but that doesn't mean that the content, the dad jokes, everything else isn't going to be here. So, Dana, what are we talking about without Joey this week?
We're going to be talking about the pre-cons that have been printed since the last time we talked about pre-cons, and there's been a lot of them. We were actually kind of shocked about how many have been out since we did this most recently.
We definitely have. So we talked about this before episode 200, so it's been quite a while, and apparently it's been over 60 episodes, which is like 100 pre-con years, so we got to talk about it again, so here we are. But let's get some shout-outs out of the way first.
First, I'd like to thank Chase, also known as Manic Curves, for helping editing the show. You can find them on Twitter at Manic Curves.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by liking and subscribing this video on YouTube, subscribing on your local podcast apps, or you can go to patreon.com/EDHRetcast, where you have patron tiers of all sorts of levels. Get yourself a nice little something in exchange for supporting the show directly. And one of the nice perks about it is you can be in the running for the weekly patron shout out. And this week, we want to give a very special shout out to Maeve Kennedy, who... Dana, you're probably thinking Dead Kennedys, one of your favorite bands. Hopefully Maeve is part of the Live Kennedys. Just my take. But either way, Maeve, thank you for the support.
Thank you very much to Maeve. And thank you to everyone who supports the show by listening or via Patreon or just clicking that like and upvote button. We do appreciate it.
Yeah, every little bit helps. We definitely appreciate every little bit of it. And you know what we do appreciate too? We talk about a lot, but pre-cons. Dana, we love pre-cons on this show. We get flack for it, but... we stand by. We love pre-cons.
We do. They are a great way to introduce new players to the game, something we've just been talking about recently on the show. But it's also a great thing to have in your arsenal, particularly if you're someone who is invested in the game as we are. You tend to tune your decks pretty tightly, and grabbing a pre-con is a good way to scale that power level back if you're looking to play against somebody who's a little bit newer to the game and wants to have kind of a slower, a little bit more dialed back experience.
Yeah, I've been a huge proponent of these pre-constructed decks for years. And I like your idea that you just said, Dana, where, you know, maybe you have decks that you got into a little bit of an arms race. They're a nice way to kind of reset the power levels. You can get everybody back on the same page. One of my favorite things that I've actually ever done with Magic was I did a pre-con league with a couple buddies where we all bought the same pre-con. And then after every game, we got to change one or two cards and our decks evolved that way. That way, the decks themselves were evolving at the same time and same rate. So nobody got ahead. Nobody just went out and just bought a whole new deck. But they all kind of got to go along together. It was a ton of fun. And pre-cons ever since then have just gotten so, so much better too.
They've gotten better, and just the ecosystem in general regarding how many we see has changed. Like for a lot of years there, it was the Commander season basically where you would get that one burst of four or five pre-con decks. And that was it for the year. Like, right, you had the Commander release and that was all we really saw the product for. Whereas the last several years, that's not how it's been. You get that burst of decks as well, but you also get, you know, two commander decks, at least for the most part, for pretty much every standard set that comes out. So there's just a preponderance of options here. If you're looking for precon decks, you can grab something new basically every time a set comes out, which is once a month-ish. I mean, it feels that way.
It does.
So there's a ton of options.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite developments about pre-constructed decks, beyond just the quality of them. If you looked at the typical deck now compared to 2013, for example, night and day difference. But
yeah,
my favorite outside of the deck a change about it has just been how often we get them. Because I remember back with Kaladesh, for example, there was a really cool mechanic called Energy where you got to accumulate resources and it was just a different resource to manage, really. And there wasn't any legend that cared about energy. So you had this really cool mechanic that didn't have a commander so you could build it as a commander deck. I don't think that would happen these days. Having a couple commander decks pre-constructed for folks right out of the box, I love it, especially when they're tied to the mechanics of the set. That way, you can build a deck around this really fun mechanic that you just got introduced to. It's such a great change, and I'm looking forward to developing that further.
Yeah, it lets them build around the mechanic in a way that is also safe and doesn't really risk them kind of polluting standard with something that's too powerful as well. You know, every reprint vehicle we have is good. Like any chance they have to throw a few reprints out there is good for the average Magic player as well. So it's just all upside. They used to print various different things. There were some Planeswalker decks that had some fairly bad versions of Planeswalkers that were standard legal. There were ones that had some legend face cards but weren't commander decks that they had printed for a while. And I mean, those were never interesting, particularly to me, and I never knew many folks that bought them. Whereas as they've switched that product to become commander decks, a lot of people I know buy those now. Like, these are something that's in demand versus something that kind of just fills space on a shelf.
Yeah, I would wager that these pre-constructed decks they've started doing, just they're the best-selling product probably just standalone outside of regular booster packs. But
sure,
I love what they've started to do. I like the development of the pre-constructed decks. And I guess we probably should start talking about the actual decks and the actual sets since the last time we had an episode devoted to pre-constructed decks. So Dana, the last set that came out after Kamigawa Neon Dynasty, that had a couple good ones. What did you think about those?
Yeah, so we started off right away with Katori, Pilot Prodigy. That deck was built around doing vehicle things. And Toshiro, the Shattered Blade, which was kind of a modified deck. So it was a deck that cared about creatures that had either aura or equipment on them, or I think plus one counters as well. So if you had one of those kind of batched effects going on, the deck cared about that. And particularly vehicles are something that's very popular. I don't know if anyone was really asking for like a batch version of a Gruul deck that cared about modified, but clearly somebody was, because that looking at those decks, that Toshiro deck is the most popular one. There's just under 4,000 of those lists out there, compared to Katori is about 1,700. So more than twice as many people out there have built that Toshiro deck versus the Katori, which was a little bit surprising to me.
Well, so you say Katori, but then also, I know Shorakai Genesis Engine wasn't the face card of that blue-white vehicle deck, but that deck, Shorakai, has over 10,000 decks to its name. So it blew it out of the water as far as what cards you could get out of the box. Now, technically, yes, you could count Goshintai of Life's Origin, which it wasn't in one of the pre-constructed decks, but it was part of the weird commander exclusive sets that you could get in collector boosters.
Yeah.
And that had 11,000 decks, but if we're going to count the actual pre-constructed decks themselves between Shorakai and Chishiro, Shorakai is vastly popular. It's super hard to top. It's one of the top 20 commanders of all time already.
And that was a deck, too, that I think was a little bit more open-ended. Katori, you basically had to play it as a vehicles deck, whereas the Shorakai deck, I think Joey even built it as a reanimator list.
Yep, he did. And that just kind of shows how flexible Shorakai was. Turns out, just being able to loot every single turn is pretty powerful. So,
right.
Give a man a graveyard and he'll reanimate for a lifetime. So,
but yeah, it was fun to see. You know, previously vehicles had existed basically in kind of the Boros space. So this opened that up as an Azorius option. And that was also nice too. It gave it kind of a different feel, a different way to play vehicles if you wanted to play vehicles. So yeah, that was it. That's kind of exactly what you want from a precon, right? You want to have those decks let you play in a space that you really didn't get a chance to play with before. And that was kind of what both those decks did.
Yeah, well, because blues had chances to be artifact matters type of stuff. Right, and so seeing it get to pair up with a different color like white, which, like you said, we don't get to see that very often. And so it was cool to see blue and white get some artifact matters type of themes to it, to have it have its own little corner of that market carved out with vehicles. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the execution of it, too. And that's all to say, like, the Gruul deck wasn't a pushover either. Chishiro.
Yeah.
Modified was super cool, and the deck, every time that I saw it out in the wild, it had the potential to get out of hand pretty quickly, too, because Modified, like you said, Dana, equipments, auras, or just any counter, so that paired very well with the next set of precons that we're going to talk about, but yeah, any counters made it Modified, and that made Chishiro quite a potent commander, too.
Well, I mean, the next batch of commanders, we might as well just kind of jump into talking about those, because that was also the set where we went from just getting the two decks that came with a standard set to also kind of the official commander release of the year. So we got five decks this time.
Yeah, and each one tied into one of the three color pairs that we saw in the main set from New Capenna. So it was kind of revisiting Alara color shards, where you had the Bant, or I forget the party name, because I my brain just doesn't work that way, but having five different three-color decks, we don't get three-color support very often, and so they really went hard at it, and I'm appreciative of that. But yeah, there was a lot of different themes going on, and everything, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of overlap beyond just the colors overlapping with so many other decks.
Yeah, that's definitely something they've gotten better about, too, I think, in recent years. You know, I think one of our complaints about a lot of the commander decks early on was they would try to split the focus of the deck between the face commander and whatever the, you know, couple of other sub commanders in the deck were. And as a result, you'd oftentimes wind up with a deck where a good portion of your cards didn't really do what your deck was trying to do based on what the commander was. There's a few exceptions, but like that was very frequently an issue. And that's maybe not the best experience for a new player. They've gotten much better about that. And the way they've gotten better about it is they've just focused primarily on that face commander. There are some exceptions. You know, if we go back to the Nian Dynasty one where Katori and Shorokai care about vehicles, there's just a lot of overlap there. So they do have some of that. But for the most part, they've just been leaning into whatever that face commander does. And I think that's kind of been the recipe for success. That's made a lot of these decks way smoother and way easier to play.
Yeah, they've dialed in and they just started caring about just the one, or just the backup commander maybe has more things to do with the face commander, because they used to try to have things going in very different ways, but they've kind of unified it a lot lately. And I do appreciate that. So you can just, if you don't like the way the one commander feels, you have another option. You don't have to change anything about the deck. It's still set to go. So for example, you had Henzi Toolbox Tori and you had the Beamtown Bullies, the Jund color, so the red, the black, and the green. They both kind of did roughly the same thing. You want to get creatures in the graveyard. They're both finding very easy ways to get creatures in the graveyard. And so, yeah, they both had ways to tie into that. And Henzi Toolbox Tori, that's one of the most popular commanders. It's a top 100 commander of all time with over 6,500 decks. So not only did they have a very tied together theme, but they were popular too.
And it was a theme like they built that Jund, you know, big creature deck and cares about big creatures, which is a Jund thing. So like not only is that does this give you a specific way in those colors to maybe come at it from a new angle, but a lot of the existing cards out there already kind of work very nicely with what you're trying to do. And they've been good about that too. We talked about how you didn't really get a chance maybe in the past to build Azorius vehicles with that Katori deck. But blue and white have always been artifact stuff. So there's just cards that like accidentally from the past have worked very nicely with that Katori deck. Same thing very much happens here, where like a lot of cards that maybe, you know, definitely weren't built with this deck in mind, but they work nicely with it because that's what Jund already does. It's kind of a logical way to play that deck. And that is something that happened with almost all of these.
Yeah, all of them were fine. My only complaint about this batch of pre-constructed decks is having played them a few times, the games just felt like a slog. I am a huge, huge fan of pre-constructed decks, but the New Capenna set, it just did nothing for me. These pre-constructed decks, I hate to say I didn't really enjoy it because I still got to play Magic, but the decks themselves, playing against each other too, nobody felt like they could pull away. Everything kind of felt like everybody's going to have some sort of an answer for everything. And so that, to me, just... I didn't love this set. And also, I don't build a lot of three color either. So maybe just the appeal there was lost on me. Whereas,
sure,
I know, I mean, we have the numbers to prove there's two top 100 commanders between Henzi Tori and Angelo the Painter, which was the Grixis face commander there. And then Tivit, Seller of Secrets, was the Esper colors. And that one is just outside the top 100. It's 101 of all commanders. Mm. So yeah, it's not that they weren't popular. Just I know personally for me, this set was the miss. But if there's one set that was a miss out of all the other sets we're going to talk about,
yeah,
I think that's just fine to have one set that didn't do great.
Yeah, and I would agree with you actually completely. This is the miss to me. And I think, to be clear, though, I don't think it's a miss as a whole. I think it's a miss to me. That's different than like not being effective.
Right.
I don't love three-color decks either. I think as a result of playing a three-color deck as a pre-con that tend to come with a weaker mana base, that naturally kind of slows things up anyway. Mm-hmm. So you spend a lot of time playing a lot of tapped lands and makes for not the most exciting gameplay in the world. But because you are in three colors, you do have access to a ton of removal. So, like you said, people do have answers, but you don't rebuild as fast. So, like, there's a lot of people, at least when I played these decks, that was my experience as well. The decks played kind of slowly. People had a ton of answers, and they couldn't recover from those answers the way you can in a normal commander game. So, a lot of factors came in. In addition to that, I just don't love three colors. I didn't love Nuka Penna as a plane. So, I had some personal things I didn't love about it, too. So, those things came together to make me probably like these decks the least of the bunch we're going to talk about. But I still think, like, on the whole, they're very well-designed decks. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of cool new cards in these lists. And clearly, people out there like them as well. So I'm not going to say they weren't successful. They just didn't, like, register with me.
Yeah, the cards themselves, if you're looking at cards in the 99, mm-hmm. you got some absolute monsters
yeah.
that went into these sets. And it's really hard to knock the cool stuff we got there. You had Smuggler's Share, Grand Crescendo. White got a lot of really cool stuff in this set, but also you had Reign of Riches. We're all looking at cards that are in at least 13,000 decks, and that's a lot of density there, too. It's just so, yeah.
Yes.
Maybe the commanders were a little fiddly in the execution, but if you look at cards in the 99, you got some just absolute bangers of cards there.
Well, the next set that we're looking at here will be the Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate decks, and there was four of those this time as well, so they went deep here. It wasn't just the two from a typical standard set. Now for me, I actually wound up kind of overlooking a lot of these just because I liked Baldur's Gate so much as a set mm-hmm. that, and there was so many legends in it too, just by virtue of how the set was made, that it made it easy to not kind of pay attention to the commander decks because there was just so much stuff happening at the same time.
Yeah. So Battle for Baldur's Gate, I mean, we've been huge on this set from day one, effectively. Mm-hmm. It's the best set or it's the worst set, depending on who you ask. We're definitely in the best set category. And you're right. Yeah. Sometimes you forget, like, oh, yeah, there are pre-constructed decks with this set, too.
Right.
And I think, if you ask me, one of the reasons that maybe the four commanders from Baldur's Gate aren't as popular as the legends in the actual set itself, probably because there's so much density there. And now, I'm saying that knowing that Captain and Gathrod, the Dimir horror pirate with horrors and mill, that's got over 6,000 decks. It's the second most popular commander from the set.
Yeah.
So it's not that it wasn't popular, but you forget that Falgorn Dreadwolf Herald is also in the set, and it's got over 3,000 decks, but there was so much going on, it was very easy to get lost, and we're still finding cards in making the show notes.
Right.
I discovered three new cards in this set.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, this was a hectic period, both in terms of how much product came out, and it was kind of a hectic period in Magic as well for us personally, because these came out when we had just went to the event, SCG Richmond event. Mm-hmm. And then the week after, I went to play at the thing in Vegas. So like I had a 2 week stretch where I was gone on the road playing Magic, basically, when these sets came out. I mean, it's all kind of a blur to me looking back. But one anecdote I will mention here is basically when I got back to town, the next day I had some friends that were having a bachelor party. And one of the things during the day they were doing was playing Magic. So I didn't want to bring my backpack of decks and stuff and have to deal with like storing it, figuring out what to do with it after the Magic event, after because we were going to go out afterwards. So I had gotten a Feldhorn precon, and I'm like, I'm just going to bring that Feldhorn deck and I'll play that. And, you know, it's easy to put in my pocket afterwards. And if something happens and I lose it, well, then I'm out of precon versus, like, you know, a very expensive deck of mine.
A real deck, yeah.
Yeah. That deck hung just fine playing with people who had been playing for years and had, like, their own personal decks they've been building for a long time. Mm-hmm. And we played four games that day, and I won two of them with that Feldhorn precon that I had never seen before. And that's not because I'm skilled. That's because that was just a really good deck.
That Feldhorn deck might be one of the top three most powerful decks out of the box they've ever made. It's absolutely bonkers. I watched it. So I got to play against Alex from Spike Feeders at the event in, Salt Lake City when we went to the Magic Summit. And we got to play these decks against each other. And holy cow, that was such a wild ride watching the things that deck does as you just take it out of the wrapper.
Yeah.
It's so silly. It's super explosive. I have one. I just haven't gotten around to playing it because I have so many other decks. But you're right. Yeah, the Feldhorn deck was absolutely silly. And I think Party Time for me, that deck, that was the Orzhov deck that had a Nalia, over 2,300 decks. But that one to me just kind of felt like the afterthought. I felt like the other three. So you had the Dimir Horrors, you had the Gruul Exile Matters, and then you had Dragons that had Furkrag with over 1,600 decks.
Yeah.
Those three felt kind of more popular to me, but then, I mean, I guess the numbers prove otherwise, and people liked the Party Time deck. I forgot about it, though.
Yeah, I kind of did, too, because I felt like everyone I saw that was building a party deck was building Burakos.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was the party commander I saw everywhere. I also kind of forgot Nalia Dhjarnis existed as a commander, so I was just had been thinking entirely of people playing that Burakos party deck. So, yeah, I mean, an embarrassment of riches, though. Like, just so many really good cards. Mm-hmm. Like, 5 or 6 years ago, all three of these commanders would be, like, would have blown people away to see these as precon commanders. And we just get so many things today that it's just easy to forget these amazing commanders atop of precon decks. Because we're just so used to great cards like this nowadays.
Well, yeah, but also, yeah, like you said, there's 69 actual legendary creatures in the set.
Nice.
Plus, a very nice number. But there's over 100 combinations of backgrounds that you can have in the command zone, too.
Yeah.
There's just so much going on. That's pushing 800 actual, like, things that can be in your command zone from this one set alone. Mm-hmm. That's so much going on. And yeah, embarrassment of riches. It's just crazy how much is going on there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's a few more of these sets we can talk about, but if you are ready, Matt, and prepared, we could go into Challenge of Stats if you want.
Do you think it would fit now? Do you think Joey would be ready if he were here?
I mean, yeah. I mean, you know how he is. We have to always, like, take him by the hand and walk him into Challenge of Stats.
I know.
It's just us, we can kind of do it a little more naturally.
Yeah, I guess you and I do have a better feeling for where Challenge of Stats should go in an episode.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I guess now would work. Yeah, let's do that. So, yeah, let's get into Challenge of Stats. EDH Rec has a lot of stats on the website. Sometimes we don't agree. So here we're going to talk about why some stats are wrong or maybe right.
My challenge this week was brought to us by patron supporter Rutabaga. And the challenge this week is for an overplay card. And he also has a replacement suggestion. And that's in Grenzo Dungeon Warden decks. Grenzo wants to cheat creatures from the bottom of your library into play. And as a creature-based strategy, it tends to want a haste enabler or two. And players tend to gravitate towards anger, the card. It's in 34% of decks for a total of 913 of those Grenzo decks. The problem is if you hit anger off of Grenzo's ability, it cheats it into play rather than into your graveyard, so it doesn't actually give your stuff haste there. Since Grenzo's base power is 2, as is anger's, you need a sac outlet to actually get anger into the graveyard to give your stuff haste, which is just a few more hoops to jump through than is ideal. A more reliable haste enabler for Grenzo is Tuk Tuk Rubble Fort, a common wall from Zendikar Rising. It's a 0-3 stat line that gives your creatures haste, and it's currently the only other creature that gives that effect, doesn't have a downside, and Grenzo can cheat that into play because of that base power. It's currently only in 109 Grenzo decks, and Rutabaga thinks the Tuk Tuk Rubble Fort number should be higher and closer to what Anger already has, considering it probably works better in that deck.
Yeah, everybody tends to default to anger as a haste enabler for red, but there's a whole world of those in red. So yeah, give something else a shot here. Well, and with that, I'm going to get into my challenge stats this week. And I'm going to talk about a pre-constructed commander because, you know, we're talking about that for the episode. So I'm going to talk about one of the new commanders, which is going to be Nayali, Sons of Vanguard. So that is the new Boros. It's tokens, really. So it's attacking tokens you control have double strike, and whenever one or more tokens you control attack a player, exile the top card of your library. During any turn you attacked with a token, you may play that card. So the card that I see in here that I'm not super sold on is going to be Siege Gang Commander. Now, I know Siege Gang is a wildly powerful card. It's great in any token strategy, but here I'm going to get a little specific on where I think it should be showing up. So Siege Gang Commander is 3 red for a 2/2 goblin that says when Siege Gang Commander enters the battlefield, you create 3 1/1 red goblin creature tokens, and you can pay 1 and a red and sacrifice a goblin, and Siege Gang deals 2 damage to any target. So with that, I'm not saying Siege Gang Commander is not a fantastic card, because it is, but if you're looking to ever really activate that ability, you only have 3 goblins that come into play short of token doublers. There aren't really in the typical deck enough other goblin makers to make Siege Gang Commander, in my mind, worth the slot. You have other fantastic and powerful token creation outlets that Siege Gang Commander, if that's your only goblin card in the deck, you probably don't want to include it. But if you're playing other stuff like Krenko's 10th Street Kingpin or anything else that's going to make goblins in mass, then sure, you have some great options like Legion Warboss. There's a whole format full of goblin token makers. So if you're going to include Siege Gang Commander, which people are putting into the deck, it didn't come in the pre-constructed deck, and it's showing up in 43% of the decks for Nayali so far, I would say you want at least 5 other goblin makers in the deck if you're going to include Siege Gang Commander. It's just something that it needs a little bit more support, because like I said, if all you're doing is just getting 4 bodies and 3 tokens out of it, there are better cards you can be playing. So if you're looking for sheer volume and quality of those tokens, there are other maybe better options you can look at. But if you're making other goblins, then yes, Siege Gang Commander, fantastic, and keep it in there. So I'm not saying don't play it in Nayali decks. I'm saying be considerate and intentional about what you're putting around the Siege Gang Commander in the 99.
Yeah, the intentionality note is really the important one there. Because there's plenty of situations where that's good, but you need to make sure your deck hasn't gravitated away from being one that runs enough goblins to have it actually be effective.
Yeah, nothing's worse than playing a card and then just not being able to really use it to its fullest potential. So
absolutely.
Well, with that said, why don't we get intentional about moving out of challenge stats and let's get into the next set. So the next set was Dominaria United. So we got 2 more pre-constructed decks with this set. We had the Painbow deck, which was the 5-color Jared Karthalian domain type of theme there. And we also had the Mardu, so the white, black, and the red Legends Legacy, so it was Legends Matter. And the cool thing about this set that always seems to get folks excited is we had Planeswalkers that can be in your command zone.
Yeah, these were really interesting. That's something that you don't really have an opportunity to get outside of a precon. You know, there's legends in every set. There aren't planeswalkers that can be your commander in every set. There's a finite amount of those, and they basically have to be an expander product, or at least a supplemental product of some sort, because they don't really work as intended in standard. So that's why we get things like these here. And yeah, we not only got planeswalkers as commanders here, we got planeswalkers as commanders in large color combinations, a 5-color planeswalker and a 3-color planeswalker. So again, they try to give us something that there is an opportunity to see a lot of elsewhere. And you know, people tend to respond to that kind of thing. That the 5-color, the Mardu deck with Diada is 3,400 people running that as their commander. That's pretty popular. It's a strong card too, but like those kind of things are what these pre-cons really excel at, giving people a thing that they don't have a chance to get elsewhere that they want.
Yeah, and both of them seemed to be fairly popular. Dehada has almost 3,500 decks, and Jared has over 2,100. So they're both fairly popular, even though they've only been out for about a year or so. But yeah, there are a lot of folks that seem to really attach onto, yeah, we get to do this thing that we don't get to do very often. And so Dehada especially, I had that pre-con, And it was pretty fun out of the box. I got to play it both with Shanid Sleeper's Scourge, which was the other legendary creatures you control at Menace. And then whenever you play a legendary land or cast a legendary spell, you get to draw a card and lose a life, which, Dana, I know is your favorite mechanic in the game.
Absolutely, yes.
But yeah, but that deck was super fun and powerful out of the box.
And people, you know, also play the backup commanders in there. Jensen Karthalion in the five color deck. There's over 1,000 decks out there. The people that chose to have that as their commander. And like you mentioned, Matt, Shanid, the other commander in the Mardu deck. There's also 1,000 decks there. People who chose to use that one. So the backup commanders in these lists were also very popular.
I feel that we need to call some attention to that there were so many decks, because this was a set also that not only did Dominaria United have a boatload of commanders in there, but also in the collector boosters, we got the Legends Revisited. So we got Hazazon, Shaper of Sand, which has almost 2,800 decks to its name.
Yeah.
We got Torowowki the Younger. So we got all these old legends from back when you and I were, you know, not diapers, but when we were kids. We got all these old legends from the original Legends set. And so having them revisited here, there were so many legends that we got in this set, like in this around one set being released. There were so many. 34 of them just happened to be around the precons.
Yeah, very similar to the Baldur's Gate set. This was a set that was kind of fighting against itself because there was just so many other legendary creatures in the base standard set as well that were fighting to be the deck you built. That this isn't a situation like we saw in the past where these were the only decks that you were given commanders for to build that particular window. There was, you know, 50 plus other options for these sets that were competing for your attention too. So, very impressive how many folks chose to build these considering the level of competition and just how many great options they give us these days.
Yeah, I mean, there are 41 commanders, eligible commanders in the set, mm-hmm. plus 34 in the pre-constructed set. That's 70 combined with the fact that earlier in the summer we got Baldur's Gate. So
yeah.
a massive influx of legends in the set. And that's not even to mention the standalone. It wasn't attached to a standard legal set, but we got the Warhammer 40K pre-constructed decks as well, which that was a whole other wave of powerful, powerful legends.
And probably in my mind, of this flight of decks we're talking about, the best designed ones.
Yes.
Yep. And maybe the best designed commander precons at least in my opinion, that I've had the experience of playing with.
See, that's really hard for me to say because there have just been so many good sets. Honestly, every set that we've talked about beyond New Capenna
for sure
has been very, very good. But the Warhammer 40K precons, you had the mono black, you had the all these different factions within Warhammer 40K. Like you had the Tyranids, you had, I don't even know all of them anymore, but like, they were all so good. And I just remember playing the decks. I got to play the mono black one and it was artifacts and creatures and milling matters. And holy cow, like once that deck got moving, it was so powerful.
Yeah, they were all really powerful. They were also packed with legends, right? So like there's the four face commanders, mm-hmm. but scattered throughout these decks, there's 24 legendary creatures spread between four decks. And they're all unique. There's no reprints here because this is, at least in terms of legendary creatures, because this is specifically a Warhammer only universe set. That's by far the most legendary stuff we've seen packed into it for precon. So it's not only are these four face commanders there available as options, there's a ton of other commanders that you could possibly play here. But what really stood out to me, because these are the first decks I think I've played in multiple pods where everyone had one of these precons, so we all played against one another and then mm-hmm. shuffled some decks around, did that kind of thing.
Yep.
They just all played really good. They were all really good games. I mean, it wasn't just one good game, a bad game here or there or whatever. Like the five or six times I've played these in pods against one another, they just played great every single time. And not just played great, but like played where the people that won the games didn't win them in the same way every time. This person won doing this one thing, and like this win happened this way. And it led to a very diverse play experience that you don't traditionally see in pre-cons. It just felt like people were playing with their own constructed decks, at least in the, you know, a little bit slower version of that thing, but like where the winning conditions were varied, there was a lot of mm-hmm. answers people could rebuild. It was a very natural feeling group of precons in a way that I probably really hadn't experienced before.
Well, and the funny part to me is all the face commanders, like we said, they were super powerful. They were doing super cool things. You had Balakor, which was the Grixis one, that has 3,800 decks to its name. You had Magus Lucia Kane that has 3,600 decks, but the most popular commander to come out of these isn't even one of the face commanders either. It's the Is It Legendary. It's Grayson Starn that has over 5,000 decks, which is super popular for how short of a time that's been out. It's number 88 of all time already.
So crazy how, and right, and not only are those numbers pretty high, these have had a really short window. These have only been out six-ish months at this point. So they've had a lot less time than a lot of the other commanders you talked about or a lot of things on the list to actually make their way through the system. And these decks were kind of difficult to get a hold of. There are a lot of folks that weren't able to find them. They sold out very quickly. So
right.
These were challenging to find. They haven't been out very long, and they've already have multiple commanders working their way up the list.
Yeah, for as loaded as every single deck was, they all were very, very capable decks. As powerful as they were, that's also how hard they were to get.
Yes.
I know the distribution behind that. I don't follow all the drama, but I know I saw a lot of folks saying, man, my LGS sold out of them, which is a good and a bad thing.
Sure.
Good because obviously they're popular, people are buying them, but also, man, I just wish more people were able to get their hands on them, because if they were, just imagine the amounts of decks that some of these commanders would have to their name. That's the part to me that just kind of blows my mind.
And they were also decks that had some really solid reprints. Like we had, you know, getting a Darkness reprint was really nice, let alone especially one that had kind of the Warhammer flavor. Things like that was just really cool to see. Different versions of Arcane Signet for depending on what the deck you're looking at.
Yeah, that was the cool part to me, was how they made the art and the frame to match kind of what each different group was doing, what factions were doing. So the Farseek and the Rampant Growth, I know, were two of the really, really cool arts there. But yeah, I loved this set. I loved playing the decks against each other. It was super fun time. I kind of did the same thing that you did. It was a buddy's birthday, so I happened to have all four of them. So I said, all right, everybody just grab a deck. Let's go. And that's what we did. And they were fantastic. We played probably five games throughout the weekend against each other. And it just, every single game was super fun.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even a Warhammer guy. Like, I don't know anything about the lore.
I wasn't either.
Yeah. But it didn't bring me into doing Warhammer stuff, but it got me reading about the Warhammer lore. And it was definitely just an interesting thing to do. And I do know Warhammer players that didn't play Magic that did start playing Magic, or at least try to pick up these precons because of the overlap. So it was just a success all around. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the Lord of the Rings decks and seeing if they can replicate how well they played, how you know, many good reprints there are, the art, that kind of thing.
I'm prepared to spend what my accountant would say an irresponsible amount of money on Lord of the Rings precons when they come out. So I feel you there. So with that said, though, we do have another set. We did get two more precons with the next Standard Legal set that came out, which was the Brothers War. We had the Brothers themselves. We had Urza, Chief Artificer, and Mishra, Eminent One. Both of those happened to be accompanying the main set. And I really liked these. These came out right around the time that we were at Salt Lake City for the Magic Summit.
Yep.
And we got to play a lot of these, and I loved how all of these played together.
We both had the same comment, too, because I think we got precons that first day we were there and played multiple games with them. Mm-hmm. And like both of us, I remember talking one out and being like, that Urza deck is busted.
Yeah.
And the Mishra one wasn't bad. It was really good too. But like, I think we both had the Urza one, and we were shocked how strong it was.
All right, so I actually had the Mishra deck, but I was...
You did, okay.
I felt cheated because I remember watching the promo videos for these pre-constructed decks, and they were saying, oh, the Mishra, it's the deck it's going to go big. It's going to get one big creature and it's going to go to town, and Mishra's going to go wide with all of its small tokens. But then I realized, oh, those small tokens... They get bigger the more of them there are. So not only does it get to go wide, but it gets to go bigger than the Mishra deck, which was supposed to be the one that goes big.
Right.
Yeah. Urza Chief Artificer was such a just silly, powerful commander. And I just could not believe what it was capable of. And that's not to say the Mishra deck, I won three games that weekend with the Mishra deck against Urza decks. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just really strong cards. They played fantastically well out of the box. A lot of the new cards that were printed for those decks synergize really well with those commanders. It felt like they printed an Urza card that was worthy of being Urza and a Mishra card that was worthy of being called Mishra. And everything kind of fell into place really, really well for these decks too. It was just a really, really good experience to play them. And there was also a lot of cards from these decks that I found to be useful in other decks as well, which is always a nice thing to have. Not only be the precon to be good, but have the precon to have good cards that you want to run elsewhere.
So I know that you and I are gushing. We loved these sets. We loved these decks. But the folks, the players loved them too. Both of these commanders got picked up pretty quickly. There's over 3,000 Mishra decks, and there's over 4,600 Urza decks out there. That's so many decks. I mean, Urza is just outside the top 100 of all time. And this deck, these decks haven't been out all that long. And then there's also backup commanders, too, that we haven't even talked about yet. Like Ashnod the Uncaring, I would probably not put it at the top of its own deck. But in the 99 of that Mishra deck out of the box, did so many powerful things.
Yeah, and did powerful things, but it also, like, they went deep on lore characters from the storyline that people have wanted to see on a card. You know, you've been getting comboed out by Ashnod's Altar for 20 years. Seeing Ashnod on an actual card was really, really cool. Being able to build an Ashnod deck was super cool for a lot of people. It just hit a lot of, like, quadrants of what people wanted from the precon in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, and I really need to shout out just how juiced the 99 of these were.
Yeah.
You could get so many powerful things. Blast Furnace Hellkite is one of my favorite, just giggle to myself watching what it does. It's 7 red, and you can have an artifact offering, so you can sacrifice an artifact and basically reduce the mana cost of it. But it has flying and double strike, and then creatures attacking your opponents have double strike. So it's basically Avatar of Slaughter. But you just get to flash it in. It's huge. Does a lot of just silly things. There's just so many fun cards in here. Machine God's Effigy was great. March of Progress. I cannot gush enough about the set.
I think Thopter Shop was one of the ones in there. The 3-mana artifact. Whenever one or more artifact creatures you control dies, you draw a card.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can tap it to make a Thopter. Like, that was just so good in that, like, that Urza precon being able to, I mean, there was so many ways to destroy an artifact you controlled, or at the very least, people trying to kill you, and you had that Thopter that you made as a chump blocker. 3-mana every turn to drop a chump blocker out there that would then draw you a card and save you from taking damage felt so good in that deck. And there was just a bunch of cards like that that just felt just perfect to be in that list.
I loved these decks. And the most powerful card, I think, in the 99 for when I was playing was the Wondrous Crucible, which is another... you get to cast stuff out of your graveyard for free, and it protects all your stuff. It's just so good. I can't say how fun these decks were to play. And yes, I will never get over the fact that my 4/4s got easily outclassed by all the armies that Urza was going to make. But man, it was so much fun getting to play these and doing these huge value plays and doing things in colors that I don't normally build in either. I've never had a Grixis deck.
Right.
And I've kept my Mishra deck intact because I just enjoyed playing it so much.
Yeah. Being able to have this set drop back to back with the Warhammer set.
We were spoiled. We were super spoiled.
Yeah.
It was a really good period.
And then we get to the last ones we'll talk about here, which is the Phyrexia All Will Be One Commander decks. And again, at least one of the two decks very much seemed to be a hit with everyone. And that's the Obzad Infect deck. Both commanders in there already. And again, we're talking with this deck, what, a month to 6 weeks they've been out?
They haven't been out very long at all. I know that folks still are just getting their hands on some of these cards.
And we're already looking at 2,500 decks for Ixhel and over 2,000 for Vishgraz. That's bonkers.
That's 4,000 decks being made out of one pre-constructed deck. That's better than most of the other decks we've seen that have been out for years. It's silly to me how popular that pre-constructed deck is. But also, we got two things that people like to do. I mean, we wanted to have Toxic. We wanted something that was going to be able to support Poison in some capacity in the command zone.
Yep.
But also, man, Vishgraz the Doomhive, I played against one of those decks and I just felt like, oof, this is doing something very, 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 very powerful.
Both those commanders really make you feel that way for sure. It just made for a it's something powerful. It was flavorful. People like Phyrexians. People like poison, or at least they like playing poison and like playing against it so much, maybe.
It's a good distinction, yeah.
They gave that a full quality that was toxic. It just, I mean, again, talking about like hitting multiple quadrants, that's kind of a best of all scenarios for the players who are looking to build those decks. You know, on the other hand, you had the Boros Rebellion deck, which is, you know,
it
kind of
it being tried. It tried.
The fourth Manning brother to Leonard Manning that really nobody knows. I mean,
it's not even kind of what that it's was. It's not even Cooper Manning. That's how bad it was.
Right. Oh. Yeah. So, and that's going to happen. It's easy to like poke fun, but like after that many hits in a row, of course, something is going to be a little bit underwhelming, and I guess I'm not shocked that it was the Boros deck as well. But
well, and to put it into perspective for folks too, Ixil, Scion of Atraxa has over 2,400 decks. That's almost as many as all the legends in the Boros deck combined.
And again, that you were, no matter what that deck looked like, it was going to pale in comparison to the Phyrexian Infect deck. That's just how that was going to work no matter what. That was a losing battle. So it is what it is.
Pretty much. And also too, we did get Urtet Remnant of Memnarch,
yeah,
which was the 5-color mirror commander. I know a lot of folks kind of got excited to see, oh, this mirror matters and whatever puns you want to throw in there, how it's just merely a mere legendary creature. That also has topped both of the charts, actually. So almost 3,800 decks,
yeah,
for Urtet Remnant of Memnarch, which is, that is also quite a few.
Yeah. The corner's just been turned. Like, I guess we're very clearly in a new age of pre-con design that probably isn't going to be ending anytime soon. But like the difference between the last cluster of decks we talked about before and this group is, it feels to me like a night and day change. Things have just moved on to another level, and I'm assuming they're going to stay here. Watsi has very clearly figured out how to do this correctly in a way that resonates with players and feels good. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of this kind of era of design moving forward with these pre-cons, because they've got it.
Yeah, they've just been super great, absolutely fantastic. I love the direction that they've been able to take them in. Mm-hmm. I can't say enough about how much they add to the format, not just for established players, but new players, like you said at the beginning of the show. They're just fantastic. So I guess my question for you then, Dana, you said Warhammer 40K might be your favorite. Would you say, of all the pre-cons that we've talked about today, if you had to pick one round of pre-constructed decks that is your favorite, what would it be?
It would be those Warhammer decks. And okay, particularly if those situation where someone's like, hey, let's get together and play something this weekend. You know, we're going to be getting a bunch of friends together and you know, drinking beers and playing EDH. What decks you want to play for pre-cons? It would be those, mm-hmm, full stop. I think they play great together. They're different experiences. You can play one deck, swap to the next one, not feel like you've kind of dropped off. They just all feel like they played really well together. They were different. They played different enough from one another. Just exactly what I want for that kind of weekend.
Nice.
How about you? What are your picks?
I'm going to give the edge to the Brothers War decks only because they came in old border. And to me, as a paper boomer, I absolutely love old border stuff. I know that one of the criticisms, I know Joey put it in the notes, so I guess since he's not here to say it for himself, it was absolutely a pain to differentiate between what was what, looking at the cards, counting your artifacts when they had the exact same border as your lands.
Yes.
It was frustrating. I will agree on that point, but I changed out the basics anyways. I mixed them up, so it eased that pain a little bit, but oh my gosh, I loved them. It's getting to play with them. I've turned my Mishra deck into old border matters, so I have only old bordered cards in there. Downfall of that is win conditions in old border is kind of hard to get.
Sure.
So the deck might be lacking in win conditions, but both of those decks were so fun to play. Not that a lot of these other sets that we've talked about haven't been great and fun to play with. I agree, Dana. Getting the Warhammer 40K decks together and just jamming them, maybe changing like 5 or 6 cards. It's all you need, really. But even just straight out of the box, that environment that they created, just those 4 decks meant to be played against each other. Mm-hmm. Everything was fair. Everything was fun. And nobody felt like they were doing anything way head and shoulders more powerful than any other deck, or at least something that one of the other decks couldn't take care of.
Yeah, that is the thing we want is to feel like it made for a really good game experience for veterans and for new players, which is not an easy thing to do. And it seemed to they pretty much nailed it. I would say, you know, if we're going to offer a minor criticism, I would like to see as many good reprints popping up in every deck as maybe we've gotten the Warhammer decks. Price on a lot of Magic cards is really difficult, is a difficult thing and a barrier for entry for a lot of people. And seeing some of those prices, you know, take a bit of a haircut when they get reprinted is always welcome. I think there's a little room for more of that in every deck, like we got in particular in the Warhammer decks. So, I mean, if we want to offer a complaint, that would be my one complaint, but, that's really it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's always hard to say because the more reprints you put into a set, the less new cards, hypothetically, you're going to be able to get. So there is a balance. And I personally enjoy the focus being on what kind of awesome new cards can we get the spotlight on?
Yes.
What can we do that we're not going to get in standard legal sets and put those in the precons instead? If that means that maybe some of the reprints aren't as good, I'm okay with that trade-off. But I do absolutely agree that we need to get reprints out there. There's some cards that just, there's no reason like the Medallion Cycle should be as expensive as it is.
Right.
It's absolutely, I mean, you and I were talking before we even started recording that Ruby Medallion is a $40 card right now. Yeah. That's so silly. And so, yes, I would have liked maybe the Mono Black deck to have the Jet Medallion in there. I think that would have been absolutely fantastic. I don't think a card like that would have been too powerful for the set that it's in, even if that was the only deck really that got a medallion in it, because it's the only one that isn't 3 colors. So there is a balance, I understand, and I do wish that we had better reprint equity, especially I think my big focus too is among the mana base. That's where I think the reprints could get a little better. Because like the Battle Bond lands, Dana, I mean, they used to be $20, but they got reprinted a couple times and now they're $3 to $5 for most of them.
Yeah, they definitely could do a much better job with the land base for sure. It's another one where, and at this point, like I understand once upon a time, they wanted to keep some of those lands to be reprinted in sets to give people something to chase down. But at this point, there's so many land cycles out there. Like there's just no reason to not, you know, jam these in just every deck. Like just there's so many lands. No one's going to be chasing those in a standard set anyway.
Yeah.
Just reprint them into the ground in precons, give people like better land, a little bit better land bases. I think that there's definitely room for that improvement for sure.
Yeah. Especially when you consider you're never going to put the Battle Bond lands into a standard legal set just because of the nature of them. They require more opponents.
Yeah.
So just put them in like everything, put them in every precon.
And yeah, you know, they're not going to put shock lands in these decks.
No,
that's
no.
Fine. I get that. I recognize that and I'm okay with that. But there is plenty of room there for other things that can help people with those mana bases and help those games. Like we talked about, some of those games, you know, are a little bit slow because of the mana bases. Mm-hmm. It'll be nice to make those be a little bit smoother for folks that are not doing quite so many, you know, land go because they are short one mana because the land came into play tap. So yeah, there's definitely some room for things they could tweak there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if we got the Lorwyn filter lands to be pennies on the dollar compared to where they were, surely we can get like the Battle Bond lands, you can get the Czech lands. I mean, that right there in a 3-color deck, that's a good chunk of your mana base, and keeping those at $2 to $5, that's so valuable for the typical player. With that said, I mean, do you have anything else you want to say about the precons, or have we kind of said it all?
You know, I think we kind of said it all. They've done a really nice job. I'm very happy with all of it. I got nothing really new to add than a few things I said. And I'm looking forward to seeing where they continue to go. I mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. I'm looking forward to seeing the universes beyond Lord of the Rings decks here that we're going to get. And I'm hoping they are just as well designed as the Warhammer 40K decks. So I am anticipating another year of fantastic precons.
Don't plant that seed of negativity that maybe they aren't in the back of my head, because I will be inconsolable if that happens. But I guess since we did just go over the definitive guide of precons over the past couple of years, why don't we wrap it up then? So Dana, on that note, where can everybody find you on the internet?
You can find me on the Twitterbirds at Dana Roach. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Matt Morgan. You can find me online on Twitter at Mathimus55. That's MathimuS55. And don't forget, Wednesday evenings, we are streaming over at twitch.tv/EDHRecCast, where we have guests on every single week. Make sure you tune in for all of that. Special thanks also go out to all of our editing staff. Thank you to Chase. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to everyone out there in listener land. Let us know in the comments what your favorite pre-cons are. Was there a certain set that you liked the most? Was there cards that we got introduced to in the pre-cons? Let us know in the comments. We definitely appreciate all of that as well. And yeah, with that, everybody have a good one. And don't forget to EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.